All right, so this week's Parsha's Ki Tavo El Aretz. The title of the class is An Acquaintance Calls and Invites Himself Over for Shabbos. So I want to, a little discussion on the first point is, here's the situation. It's repeated itself multiple times, and it will in your life. Scenario number one, an acquaintance calls and asks slash invites themselves over for Shabbos in your New York City apartment. They can attend MG. If you have an apartment in MG, as you have noticed, if you have an apartment in Manhattan, that's gold. Jerry is gold. And and people want to come over. And they drop right Wall's name. saying that Rabbi Wall suggested you, and you're not in the mood. So describe what goes through your mind.
Yeah.
All right, one at a time.
Yeah, no one's talking. I was going to say guilt.
So you feel guilty. So articulate the conflict. What are the two sides of the conflict, and what's underscoring each side of the conflict?
Well, let's just say, you're just, I don't want to say not in the mood, but you're just not up for hosting yet. One of the, I don't know if it's considered mitzvot, but I've learned in many classes that you're supposed to open up your home. And if somebody, wants to come to MJE and they need a place to stay, you don't want them to not come because they don't have a place to stay. I mean, it's the right thing to do.
Well, okay. So on the other hand, what's the challenge of hosting? Or what are the, better yet, what are the challenges of hosting?
We need to be a gracious host and make things nice for your guests. Right.
So there's many parts to that. One part is cleaning up your apartment. Ugh. Number one. And number two is if there's a guest room or a couch that's going to be converted, you got to make them feel comfortable. Basically, you got to be on. You got to be the host with the most or the hostess with the mostess, right? It's a little bit of a stress. Not impossible. It's a little stress. So that's it. And basically, if you had a rough week, you sort of like want to crash. You know what I'm saying? It's like the weekend's coming. You want to like just sort of decompress, and you don't feel like being on, right? So those are the conflicting emotions. Anyone want to add to that? What other factors go into the consideration?
Well, I guess also how close you are to this acquaintance. Do you trust them in your apartment?
Right.
Just to give you an example, I know Sean, before we got married, had slept on this couch many times, and Larry would leave him a key, and he's someone who he trusts. He's someone who he's comfortable with, but
right.
He might not have felt that way about, anybody.
Right.
So there's a trust factor there as well.
Right. Right, but assuming they're acquaintance of you trust them. I didn't put the word friend because friend, you're a friend. That's already a friend basically means that you have a level of relationship that basically the answer is going to be yes, unless you really can't do it.
Right, that's true.
But then there would be no scenario.
Right, true.
There would be no conflict there.
Right.
Okay, so let's move it to scene number two. Let's say the person asked you, and it's a week before Yom Kippur. Would that play a role in the response? What do you say, Mariana? What do you say?
I don't know.
You think that would increase? Would that increase the chance of saying yes, or decrease the chance of saying yes?
Decrease.
Decrease what? Decrease the chance of saying yes.
Yeah.
Why do you think that?
I don't know. Maybe you're busy prepping for the high holidays and you don't want to deal with having to socialize with an extra person.
Right. So that might be a reason not to do it because you're trying to organize everything for the high holidays and you're actually legitimately busy. Who would argue the other way? Sean?
I think it would make you more likely to do the hospitality because you want to like squeeze in another mitzvah before Yom Kippur.
Rack up another mitzvah point before we roll into Yom Kippur.
I guess I'm not as nice.
But whatever. That, I'm not saying that person would do it, but the question is, will that be the calculation? Okay. All right. All right. Elise, do you agree with that? Suzanne?
Yeah. I mean, I know how I am. I may be grumble a lot, but I'll do it because I know ultimately it would be the nice thing to do and I would feel good about it, but I may, you know, grumble, but ultimately, and maybe then feel guilty and I'd go back and forth 100 times, but know that I would do it, maybe beat myself up a few times, but ultimately do it.
Okay. So it becomes a whole psychological,
yes,
internal, it becomes an internal soap opera going on there.
Yes.
Forth. All right. Good. So, all right. Now we go to scenario number three. One of my favorite, because this is somewhat autobiographical. It's the morning of your dental cleaning appointment. I don't know about you, but I try to go every 6 months. Okay, for the old cleaning and checkup with the dentist. Recommend it. It's recommended. Now what do most people do the morning of before seeing the dentist?
They floss,
right. People, no matter how much the doctor tells you the importance of flossing, flossing is annoying. See, toothbrushing has an advantage because it helps you have good breath. If you didn't get good breath because of toothbrushing, people wouldn't do toothbrushing either. It's just that you don't want to be gross, nor is walking around to work or school or whatever without brushing. You personally feel gross, and you feel gross about everybody else. So that's the advantage on the toothbrushing piece. But flossing, nobody knows that you haven't flossed before since the last time you went to the dentist. You know, but why is a person going to floss the day of when they're going to go to the dentist? Let's explain that.
You don't want to get in trouble by your dentist.
Right, because you know the dentist is going to ask you, you know, going to give you the dental report card. They ask you that question, Timmy, have you been flossing? And the answer is always say, oh, sure, I floss like crazy. Yeah, you got three cavities and you need a crown, but you're doing a great job flossing. Right? So you feel this emotion like you're back in fourth grade. You know, you might be in your 30s. You might be in your 40s. You might even be 50, like me. For some reason, you know, comes to the dentist, you're like, you're doing extra brushing, you're doing extra flossing. So whatever you didn't do from the last 6 months will magically be transformed in the matter of 25 minutes. Okay? Now, looking at it in a much more objective way, what is intrinsically what is the error that I'm making when I do that? What's the error in thought that I'm doing when I'm doing that?
You're believing you can cover up something that you've systemically been not doing.
Right. That's one. Okay. That's one fantasy. Correct. That's one magical thinking. Magical thinking number one. But there's more. What else?
That you're going to fool your dentist.
Right. Also, you're not going to fool the dentist. The guy can tell the state of health and well-being, oral health and well-being of your mouth, because that's all he does all day long. And, you know, and you can see he even has an x-ray from the previous time. You can see the nature of the circumstance. And if there's been greater degree of decay, or there's been a recession of your gum line, or there's more gum disease, all the telltale, he knows you're lying. You're not fooling him. But there's a third magical thing, which I think is the most magical thing, which is the most foolish of these activities. There's a difference between an activity and a lifestyle. An action versus a program. The reality is, it doesn't really make a difference what your dentist thinks about you at all as being a good, you know, good person in regards to oral health or not. The question is, do you have good oral health? And doing the good deed of flossing once in 3 months, that's not the goal. The goal is not to do an action of flossing. The goal is to have systemic healthy habits which provide good oral hygiene. You know what I'm saying? The goal is not to do a ceremonial flossing before I go to the dentist. You know what I'm saying? That's not the goal. The goal really is to have oral health. Either I do or I don't. And if I'm, you know, there's no idea of, and you can't, and as Michael pointed out, you can't get better oral health, you know, doing one action one time. So it goes the same thing back to, now our topic today is not oral health, but the health and well-being of a person's soul. So Elise is correct that to provide, you know, food and shelter for somebody who doesn't have it is the mitzvah of hachnasat orchim, taking in guests, which is a mitzvah, a structure of a mitzvah, which is a reflection of a general principle of loving your fellow Jew as yourself, and in general doing chesed, extending kindness to others. So it's not about, it's not only the good deed of doing it, it's really inculcating that quality or virtue within yourself. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's about a, in other words, extending, you can look at doing Hachnas Orchim as part of your exercise to develop a charitable, gracious, compassionate soul. You know what I'm saying? In a certain sense, it's not about them. You know, it's about them, but it's also about you. You know what I'm saying? So when you do the act of hospitality, okay, you're doing two things. A, you're providing, you're taking care of their need. They are a person, you know, who has a, you know, the divine image, has created and has given a mind by God and is given a special quality by God, and therefore is entitled to certain rights. And you recognize that by providing for them something they need, which is in this case Shabbat hospitality. But the main point is that by doing so, you're providing yourself, you're exercising your generosity muscle, your kindness muscle, and therefore, which will result in having a generous soul. Do you know what I'm saying? A kind soul. It's not doing a ceremonial action. It's not simply to respond to guilt, although that, you know, we don't want to, we'll, you know, whether you do it for the right reason or the wrong reason, it still activates the muscle. You know what I'm saying? So in regards to this, person should push themselves, you know, within reason, because they're not only helping out that person, but fundamentally the primary beneficiary of all these actions in halacha, which are what you call bein adam lechaver, between you and your fellow Jew or fellow person, and that is really developing internally the health and well-being of your soul. Before I go on to show you how that's anchored in our parsha, before I go on, do you understand that point? Is that point clear? Sean?
It's clear.
Okay, so we're accomplishing, or so when you do an act of kindness, generosity, sensitivity, chesed, you know, between or refraining from activities, not speaking lashon hara, being calm, you know, going on a shiva visit, you know, providing comfort to people, you're helping that person, but you are equally, possibly even more, helping your own, exercising that quality in your soul as being a strong principle of action for you. You know what I'm saying? That's why, you know, similarly, when you have children, it's very important to get them involved. Let's go back to Hakanas Orchim. So when I have guests over for Shabbos, I purposefully weave in my children in the process. So I like to make, when I have a guest room, I make the people have a hospitality bowl. In other words, they have the room made up nicely, right? And there's a little bowl with some water and some fruit and candy. So this way, when they're like, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning and they feel thirsty, they don't have to, you know, sneak into the kitchen, you know, like, and try to find some, you know, this way they can comfortably have everything, you know, that they might need in their room. You know what I'm saying? A little snack, a little this, you know what I'm saying? Or I'll have them help me make the beds for them, welcome them. It's important. So, because I'm really doing is I'm trying to pass on the habit of welcoming people in, being generous of spirit. You know what I'm saying? I'm working on myself, and I'm also working on my kids. You know what I'm saying? It's the same idea. What any of the mitzvahs, bein adam l'chaver, between you and your fellow, you should do yourself, and then when you have children, to do that with your child. Because those are the core values that you get, not by discussing it, you got to discuss it and analyze it, but also by doing it. You know what I'm saying? I was discussing with somebody who, interestingly enough, you know, is from a more Eastern religion tradition. And there's a part of Judaism which also has an Eastern religion element that it's holistic. It's not about pure cognitive learning, which we're doing now, but also, you know, the action component or the experiential component is equally, if not more, important. Okay, it's just important to know that. All right, let's now. I'm going to do is like as I do in the past. I'm going to have you guys read the part. This little parsha unit. I'm going to pause the recording here. Hold a second. Pause the recording.
A tzaddik in our time.
Yes.
He's like the mitzvah king.
Yeah, he was a particularly gifted person, yeah. Rabbi Arya Levine.
It's very amazing reading.
Yeah, we went with last year, not this year for the fellows, but we went, his son, Rabbi Benji Levine, gives a tour of that area of that neighborhood of Jerusalem, and he shares stories about his father, which is amazing. Very, very, some very moving thing.
It's really
He was amazing. A very special person.
Right.
But he was known as being a person who really had mastered this area. His Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, his interpersonal relationship between him and a fellow Jew was just remarkable. But it didn't happen like he was born that way. That's a very important point. You don't believe in a person born naturally good. A person has to be work on them. Some people might come a little easier for some than others. I'll give you an interesting story. Rabbi Soloveitchik, we have to have at least one Rabbi Soloveitchik story per class. will not be denied. Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather was named Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. And he was, of course, the brilliant Talmudist worked out this new area of Talmudic thought analysis called the Brisker Derech, the Brisker Way. But one of his amazing things was that he was a person who was like very generous and compassionate. Like you come into that guy's house, he'd have a widow sleeping on the couch there. There'd be poor people. Like he'd have people sleeping in his own bed, and he'd sleep on. And so his grandfather said, I think to his son or to his grandson, he says, "Look, I want you to know that naturally, I'm a very cruel person. In other words, naturally, I'm not generous." It was a quality that he had worked on himself to become. It's not like he naturally was a Mother Teresa kind of guy and therefore he was very giving and kind. No, he was the opposite. He was a mean person intrinsically. And he worked on his personality and he became, in fact, on his tombstone, they put two words on his tombstone, Rav Chesed, abundant of loving kindness. So even though this guy is one of the great Torah greats of the 10th and 20th century, what was more amazing to people was his unbelievable compassion and kindness, but it wasn't natural. It was what he worked upon himself. In the same way that a person walks into a gym, does not have a very good physique, but if they work with personal trainers, they can accomplish a great deal. He did that to his own soul and personality. That's one of the amazing qualities about Judaism is it has amazing hope and aspiration for man that man can change and man can develop and man can give him or herself good qualities and can improve step by step. It's a very high assessment of the potential of every person. Okay, that's something that Judaism has a lofty aspiration, while simultaneously not, denying that man could be a loser, could be a wicked person. Not sugarcoating reality, but having a great hope and destiny for people. Man could accomplish a great deal, mankind. Anyways, going back to these blessings here. So let's got a little distracted over there. All right, questions on this little parsha unit. We're in chapter 28, 1 through 14. All right, so I'll focus in. I mean, basically, who could summarize? Who could, in their own words, what is the Torah telling us? Who could reduce these 14 sentences into a couple sentences? Sean?
Basically, like if you follow the commandments, like you'll have everything you need.
Yes, you will be blessed with all these material blessings. Is it you as an individual?
The people, the Jewish nation.
Right. So if the Jewish people as a whole follows the Torah properly, whatever that is, the Jewish people will be blessed with unbelievable material, physical, financial, political well-being. Well, you can guess what the other 54 verses are going to be after that. The reverse is also true. Okay. Now, I want to focus in. Let's focus our attention on verse 9. Okay, Marianne, I'll read out the verse out loud to everybody.
If only you keep the commandments of God your Lord and walk in his paths, God will establish you as his holy nation, as he promised you.
Okay, what is question or unclear about that verse?
What does walk in his paths mean?
There you go. Bingo. That's a very vague term. So give me some possibilities here.
Well,
walk in his path, as in follow his rules, do what he wants to do, follow in his way.
Right. 100%. So you would think it's sort of a general exhortation, encouragement to follow the Torah in general. Walk his ways, follow the Torah. But then that, but what's the challenge with that interpretation in that sentence?
It seems to be saying the commandments are just actions you can take, and being what the actions represent is different somehow. It's like an intrinsic change.
Well, if Elise reading, which is a very logical really reading, which by the way, in other parts of the Tanakh does mean that, but if it's like, if it says if you only keep the commands of God your Lord and walk in his path, it makes it redundant. In other words, if you're keeping the commandments, well, obviously, isn't that walking this path? Isn't that one and the same thing? So interestingly enough, sometimes it does refer to that contextually, but the rabbis, the oral law, saw that this is something different. This is something extra. Now, what does it mean to walk? Now, obviously, walk in his path. Now, you can also argue that walk in his path does not refer to doing mitzvot because God does not do mitzvot. So a very literal reading of walking in his path can't be walk in the mitzvot because he's not doing mitzvot. Give me another possibility.
Try to be, well, this is going to sound weird. Try to be like God, like nice, forgiving.
Okay. Not only does that sound weird, but that actually is the mitzvah.
Oh,
that is actually correct. The Hebrew word of these words, walk in his path, is the Hebrew, v'halachta bidrachav, and you walk in his path. So question is, but then there's a little problem. What's the challenge of that? That's problematic also. That poses a problem. What problem does that pose for us and on us? Well, we're not God. So how can we be expected to act like God if we are in fact not God? You know, it's like saying, like, you have to fly like a bird. Well, I don't have wings. I don't have that capacity. It seems to be asking us to do the impossible. Okay, so we're going to get into that. All right, so let's have somebody read out loud. Michael Doze, read us out. I'm taking this from the Rambam to expand this mitzvah in the laws of character traits, what they're called Hilchot Deot. This is the first chapter. I am dropping you in the middle here, but we can't do the whole thing. All right, good. I'll help out.
The straight path. This involves discovering the midpoint temperament of each and every trait that man possesses within his personality. This refers to the trait which is equidistant from either of the extremes without being close to either one of them. Therefore, the early sages instructed the man to evaluate his traits, to calculate them, and to direct them along the middle path so that he will be sound of body.
Okay, here we're going to go from the example to be more clear. Go on.
Read the example?
Yeah.
Okay. He should not be wrathful, easily angered, nor be like the dead, without feeling. Rather, he should adopt an intermediate course. Ergo, he should display anger only when the matter is serious enough to warrant it, in order to prevent the matter from recurring. Similarly, he should not desire anything other than that which the body needs and cannot exist without. As Proverbs states, the righteous man eats to satisfy his soul. Also, he shall not labor in his business except to gain what he needs for immediate use. As Psalm states, a little is good for the righteous man. He should not be overly stingy nor spread his money about, but he should give charity according to his capacity and lend to the needy as is fitting. He should not be overly elated and laugh excessively, nor be sad and depressed in spirit. Rather, he should be quietly happy at all times with a friendly countenance. The same applies with regard to his other traits.
Okay, so the Rambam says here that we all have character traits. Anger, generosity, courage, work. So what the Ram is saying is that the person should, this is what they call the golden mean. Have you heard of that before? The Greeks also adopted this idea, also maintained this idea, okay? That a person should be moderate, you know what I mean? Person should not be a person who is, you know, angry guy yelling at everybody every second, but the person should not be like emotionally dead and not, if somebody does something, if you see your kid about to run into the road, you don't say, Junior, step away from the road there. That could harm you fatally. No, you yell at that kid because he's got to know, not that you feel anger, but you convey anger because you don't want the child to kill themselves. Or person should not be like morose and sad and Mr. Depressed dude, you know, negative Ned or negative Nancy, Debbie Downer, but should not be Mr. Laughing, you know, should be find that middle space and try to adopt the middle approach. Okay. Generosity. He should not like throw his money around like crazy, but he should be charitable. And if people need money, either give them as a gift or as a loan. Person, you know, get, you know, either extreme. All right, let's go on. Let's see how he develops this.
Going.
This path
is the path of the wise. Every man whose traits are intermediate and equally balanced can be called a wise man.
Now, I ask you, why is that person called a wise man?
He's focusing all of his energy on the mitzvot, and everything else he sees as being in the middle and secondary to that.
Well, one second. Is being angry a mitzvah or not being angry a mitzvah?
Nobody's not engaging those in any way that distracts from his mitzvah involvement.
No, but what makes him called a chacham, a wise man, is because he's calibrating as a principle of action the right level of involvement in all these pursuits. How much joking around, how much seriousness, how much generosity, how much being reserved financially, how much involved at work, rest of life, you know, working on the job, not working. Anger, you know, emotional deadness. You know what I'm saying? These are not mitzvahs per se, but he's called a chacham by calibrating it precisely. Now, my question is, why is he called a chacham? If I use the term chacham, you would say, oh, he's a person who has a lot of either general knowledge or Torah knowledge, right? I don't think you'd ever say you'd call this guy a chacham. A wise person. Wise person, a wise person.
Because this is the ideal person that most people want to surround themselves with.
Well, you'd call that person the popular person, the pleasant to be around person, but why is he called a wise person?
Well, in Pirkei Avos, doesn't it say a wise person is someone who learns from everybody?
Eizeh ha-chacham ha-lomim mikol adam. Correct. But he's giving a different definition of chacham here. Because the reason why he's called the chacham there, because a measure of a wise person is a person who's a truth seeker, and he's not, has no egotistical blocks to get that knowledge. In other words, even though he didn't think of the idea, he's happy to get it from somebody else. You know what I'm saying? He doesn't need to be the big macher. This guy has a great idea. I'm all ears. I don't have to be the originator. I could be the student. He has, in his pursuit of truth, he has no ego whatsoever. Whoever has the truth, he's there. Doesn't care where it comes from. He's completely open. But apparently, that's not the only measurement and metric of a wise person. Why is this guy called a wise person?
This person seems to know how to balance himself, which seems very nice. he knows not to lose it, not to be over dramatic, not to be so dull. He has this nice balance, which, well, to me, it seems like you have to keep a cool, intelligent head about yourself.
Self-control.
Well, but in order to have self-control, what do you need more than just self-control?
You have to think about, well thought out.
Exactly. He or she has to be extremely well thought about every part of their life. They have to think through all the implications of their actions. You know what I'm saying? And the reason why this guy is a wise person, because this requires a lot of general knowledge, a lot of self-knowledge, and a lot of, you know, being very careful about consequences. I mean, let me give you a simple situation. Let's say you have, imagine a mother and daughter, okay, who do not have a good relationship. Every third time they speak on the phone, one of them hangs up yelling. Can you visualize that? Have you seen that? Is it you? Don't. Okay. But the bottom line is that person is struggling because there are certain triggers, emotional triggers in the dynamic between mother and daughter that are being triggered that they cannot work out a strategy around. They know that it's to get into the exact same fight they've had since they're 14, the last 20 years, is a pointless exercise. They know it's ridiculous. It's only bad, but they haven't worked out a way to navigate around that. They don't have that trait of balance, of knowing how to navigate certain situations. Okay? Or certain people that, you know, there are people that because they can't, certain people, they can't say no, so they're always giving money out. They're too generous. And there are people who are nervous about giving away money because they feel if they give out $10, $20, their whole lifestyle will be removed, which is also not true. Each person is living under a fantasy about their about the role of money in their life. The person who's a chacham has thought this through and has a very thoughtful, reflected approach to this area, and therefore they know how to act in every circumstance.
So, can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
As a mitzvah, this is supposed to be doable. So, is there like a list of all of the traits and how other people would know if they're balanced in you?
Well, that is the subject matter of the entire section of the Rambam of the seven chapters of Hilchot Deot. It's a seven chapter unit in the Mishnah Torah. We're only doing three. We're doing three halachot. But here's the punchline. Let's read to number five. Go ahead, Michael.
We are commanded to walk in these intermediate paths, and they are good and straight paths, as Deuteronomy states, and you shall walk in his ways.
Ah, so this is not just simply good advice. This is actually a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah of Al-Ashra B'Drakha. Now let's find out where we get this from. Let's keep on rocking it.
Our sages taught the following explanation of this mitzvah. Just as he is called gracious, you shall be gracious. Just as he is called merciful, you shall be merciful. Just as he is called holy, you shall be holy. In a similar manner, the prophets called Hashem by other titles, slow to anger, abundant in kindness, righteous, just, perfect, almighty, powerful, and the like. They did so to inform us that these are good and just paths. A person is obligated to accustom himself to these paths and to try to resemble him to the extent of his ability.
Uh-huh. So for example, we're going to coming up on the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur season. And one of the things that gets repeated a lot, whether it be on the Slichot or on Yom Kippur, is we say, Hashem, Hashem, El Rachum V'Chanun, Erech Apayim Rav Chesed V'Hesed, you know, God, oh Lord, Lord, who is gracious and kind. These we call the 13 attributes. So the question is, why did God, quote unquote, reveal that? Now, by the way, is God really merciful? Does God feel mercy?
There's the God of Rachamim. We believe in that side of him, also the Din.
Does he feel compassion?
God does not feel.
Exactly. So what these, in other words, God does actions which are expressed in the Tanakh in our framework. He does actions within our framework look gracious, which look merciful, which look holy, which look slow to anger, just, perfect. So the bottom line is, these are being expressed because these are listing the ideal human qualities. And we, our goal is to try to emulate that to the extent that we can. Okay? It's not a concrete mitzvah. It's not like if I get angry, you know, I didn't do the mitzvah. I have to endeavor to try to calibrate these areas. All right, let's read the last halacha, then we'll put it all together into a nice package. Yeah, Michael.
How can one train himself to follow these temperaments to the extent that they become a permanent fixture of his personality? He should perform, repeat, and perform a third time the acts which conform to the standards of the middle road temperaments. He should do this constantly until these acts are easy for him and do not present any difficulty. Then these temperaments will become a fixed part of his personality. Since the Creator is called by these terms, and they make up the middle path which we are obligated to follow, this path is called the path of God. This is the heritage which Avram taught his descendants, as Bereshit states, "For I have known him so that he will command his descendants to keep the path of God." One who follows this path brings benefit and blessing to himself, as the above verse continues, "so that God will bring about for Avraham all that he promised."
Uh-huh. Okay. So basically, it's funny that the Ram says this. There's a branch of psychology called positive psychology. Positive psychology is basically the approach of psychology of trying to figure out people who are successful, whether they be happy in life, to study happiness, to study different things of people who are successful in life and try to emulate those qualities. So one of their great breakthroughs is the power of habit. And their basic belief is as follows. Their research says like this. If you want to get a good quality, all right, pick any of these qualities. Let's say generosity or whatever, kindness. Pick any of these qualities you want. They said you should repeat it for 30 days. It should be in a small doable amount. You should have a partner who will help you with that. And the goal is to make it into a habit. Because once it's a habit of excellence, it doesn't require you to think about it anymore. You can be able to just do the habit. Everybody here, it also works in reverse. If you pick up a bad habit, let's say you spend 2 months not exercising. And then you try to go exercise, it's going to be very painful. Conversely, if you have exercised for 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, working out is like an effortless activity. You know, the resistance is not great. So basically, what the Ram is suggesting here as a way to adhere to qualities of excellence here, of the perfect middle path, not too angry, not too emotionless, not too generous, not too stingy, not too obsessed with work, not caring of work. To get that middle path is to try to develop a habit of that. I will share with you, the Rambam discusses all this in these seven chapters of the section, which is available online for free. So the going back to our initial point, the issue of an acquaintance calls and invites themselves over for Shabbos, and, you know, let's say you have the resistance of, let's say, my home is my castle. I don't want anybody to invade my home and hachnas orchim of doing kindness to others and welcome them into your house and into the community is something which is difficult. So what's the Rama's prescription?
Invite them over and be exceptionally gracious about it.
Right. You push yourself to do it. And then what do you do then? Then what?
try to be mindful of their needs, of how they'll be happy, of all those things that are against your nature.
Right, but you basically, you do it repeatedly until it becomes not a problem. All of us have experienced this. Everybody's experienced this. Everybody, there's something which is very, for whatever reason, emotionally distasteful to us. Okay? And for whatever reason, we force ourselves to do it, and you do it time one, time two. The way, if you do it by time 10, it's not as problematic. Let me give you a story that I think exemplifies this. I had a student 20 years ago and was, you know, new in business but having financial success. And the person was very nervous about giving charity. Okay? Not easy. And, you know, they didn't come from money, and it wasn't something that they necessarily saw in the home. And they knew they had to do it, but it was just emotionally very difficult. So how do you solve that problem? You give a little, often. So the person gave, and I saw with the person that time one and then time two, the resistance to give, you know, was a little less. And when they gave the money, they start to recognize that fundamentally their lifestyle did not change. They felt good about it at the end, but they had to overcome that initial, like, taking off. It's like taking off the Band-Aid. It's like, you don't want to do it. It's painful. I don't want to do it. You take it off. You know, it's not so bad. And then the same thing happens. One of my initial fundraising mentors was the vice chairman of Bear Stearns, a guy named John Rosenwald Jr. So John Rosenwald Jr. was a Jew, was a philanthropist. He himself personally raised $2 billion to his many of his causes, including the Met. Bear Stearns, which did not make it through the financial crisis, but that's another story. You can Google that one. They had a rule. This is an interesting rule. They believed in this. Their initial head CEO was a Jewish guy, and they wanted to distinguish themselves by being very charitable to UJA. So they had the following rule. If you're on the executive level of the organization, we're going to hold in escrow 4% of your income, of your salary. You can give it to any charity, any 501c3 you want. And you have 12 months to do it. But if you do not do it, you lose it. Okay, that was their approach. All right? Obviously, they wanted to be, you know, there's UJA has different divisions, and they're the finance division, and they wanted to raise the most money for UJA, which is a beautiful thing. So guys who are not, this applied to Jew and non-Jew, no discrimination, right? So people who, like, these are guys who are making bajillions of dollars, you know, these are the one percenters, all right? They were like nervous, like, you know, I will, like, be able to go to my, my vacation in St. Bart's and my yacht and my house in the Hamptons. And they're like nervous, like the 4%. And then because the company had that rule, they gave it. And suddenly this guy's giving to the homeless, and this guy's giving to UJA, and this one's giving to a yeshiva, and this one's giving to that. And before, you know, everybody for their own interests. And Bear, and John Rosenwald says, he says, you know, he said two things to me. He says, you know something? They start to notice that it did not affect their life at all. It was all an illusion. And only that, they start to enjoy giving. And then there's another thing which he believed, which is another Jewish principle. This is particular to giving. The more you give, the more you get. The more you give, the more you get. So that was his, you know, belief. It's also an idea in Judaism in general. So this is an example of, there was tremendous resistance. The company, the Jewish, not Orthodox guy, had the belief that it's not right. You're the one percenters. You can, you know, you can afford it. You're not gonna stop sending your kid to Horace Mann, and you're still gonna be able to be in Southampton for the weekend, And, you know, that Christmas vacation in St. Bart's is going to happen. And the wife is going to get a nice piece of jewelry for her birthday or the, you know, and it ain't going to do. But meanwhile, you have the capacity, especially, or, you know, company-wide in general, everything's built. We can do a lot of good together. And it was, but once they got into the habit, it became second nature. That applies to every quality, courage versus fear, obsessed with food and drink and total the opposite. Everything a person could habituate himself toward the middle way. Now I'm saying it's not easy. That's why the person who does that is called the chacham, because you have to have a lot of knowledge of the psychology and a knowledge of yourself. And it ain't easy, but that's the mitzvah of the thing of halakta v'drachav. Many mitzvot. Here's the punchline here, guys. Many of the mitzvot bein adam l'chaveiro, between yourself and a fellow person, are giving you a halachic structure to accomplish these virtues. In other words, they're not. So the halakha demands, for example, not that you care about your friend who lost their father or brother or sister. You have an obligation, if your friend is sitting Shiva, to go spend quality time and visit with them and be there for them. Be your friend. You know, even though, like, in every, and I'll just talk about myself. I'll tell you a very funny thing. As a rabbi, you know, I know a lot of people. So there's a shiva, okay? You know, you start to think, well, I'm not so close to the guy. Do I really have to go? It's Sunday afternoon. I wanted to do something else, or I wanted to do nothing. So I force myself. All right, I'm going to go. I'm going to go to the shiva. That's it. I go to the shiva. I'll tell you, I always have the same experience afterwards, and to the extent that now I don't have the same internal conversation. I go, I felt that, you know, person felt validated, felt good that people care about them. I was able to, share something with them. They felt, you know, in a time of lowness that their people, the community rallied around them. And I leave the shiva, I feel good. I didn't want to go. I wanted to stay on the couch. I had to unspatula my tuchus off the couch, you know, but once I got going and I went, I felt that they felt good and I felt good. And I felt that I had helped my empathy muscle, my sympathy muscle, my community building muscle, those qualities of soul were strengthened. So, you know, Rome is not built in a day. These are we all have these qualities, but many of the mitzvahs are designed to, between interpersonal mitzvahs, are designed to build this muscle in our soul of compassion, sensitivity, and it requires honesty and assessment of yourself. And that really is a major mitzvah, the halakha v'drachav, to walk in God's ways as best as we can. To have a principles of action which are thoughtful and are measured, you know. So it's the goal is not just to act, but to act thoughtfully and strategically in every way. And it's hard. It's hard. You get angry. You want to yell at somebody. Again, talking about myself, of course. So to restrain yourself. To habituate yourself, to step into the person's shoes. What does that person feel? What is that person going through? What does this situation mean to them? Instead of thinking about ourselves, to step out of our own selfish bubble. It's a job, but it's the Torah is trying to elevate us, and that's really why it's a mitzvah in the Torah. It's a big mitzvah in the Torah. Walk in God's ways. All right. This is a big topic. I just really wanted to introduce you to this topic. People use the term working on midot. It's the same idea. It's actually a mitzvah. Okay. So if you want to read more about it, it's online. Hilchot Deot, character traits in English, online, Chabad, other places. You can read it. 7 chapters. but it's a, but it's something where you can have tremendous, tremendous personal growth and gain. All right. Is, any questions about it?
Is this the same as like the concept of Derek Eretz, or is that different?
So Derek Eretz is a term that use is that's used in a couple of senses. One term of Derek Eretz, like you learned in Pirkei Avot, means the way of the land, which means working. Like for example, Pirkei Avot says Yafeh Derek Eretz in Torah. It is good that a person has a good work learning balance, otherwise known in the way I like to call it, a learner earner. You want to be a learner earner. You want to be learning and you want to be earning. You don't want to be just learning and you just want to be just earning. You want to be a learner earner. Okay? You want to have a balance. That's one idea of Derek Eretz. Second idea of Derek Eretz is what we call, is expressed an idea of sensitivity and regard to others. In other words, when a person acts rudely, people will use the phrase like, this guy doesn't have any Derek Eretz. Or if a guy is a rude, insensitive, boor, selfish yutz. Somebody may have been on some dates with such people. Okay, they're called no Derek Eretz, all right? So so a person who has good midot, good inner qualities, good day, you know, has good Derek Eretz. So but the term is used in two ways. You have to get a context from what that is.
Okay. Can I ask a question on the pasuk?
Yes.
It seems to list the blessings and say follow the commandments at the beginning, and then it seems to do it again in the middle. Yes. So is that like an individual national thing, or is it something else?
He's talking for the Jewish people as a whole. But notice if they after nine, it says keep the commandments and walk in his path, and then the whole thing gets elevated to a new level. All the nations of the world will realize that God's name is associated with it, and they will be in awe of you. In other words, that's a qualitatively new level. In other words, because you could say it's repetition. In verse 1, it says, if you obey the God your Lord, keeping all his commandments that I'm prescribing you, then he says you'll make the highest of all nations. He gives you blessings 1 through 7. Then he says, then in 9, 1 through 8 rather, then in 9 he seems to be saying the same thing.
Yeah,
but then the next level of blessing is an uber level, because we're talking about people who have inner refinement. And it'll be so evident that the nations of the world will take notice. I'll give you a story. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, famous halachic decider of the last, he died in 1986. I was at the funeral. I never got a chance to meet him. He was known also as a person of tremendous sensitivity. So his yeshiva was in the Lower East Side, and on his way walking to the yeshiva, he would say good morning to everybody. You know, whether a person be Jewish, not Jewish, male, female, wealthy person, poor person, he had this sort of general regard and conscientiousness about to other people. And so much so that people really resonated to that. They saw this guy was a special person, because he was not just, it wasn't a one size fit all, hi, good morning. It was really, he was really thoughtful in his engagement of all people. And it's not something that, people felt that. In other words, they felt this is a special person. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So when people see that, when you're operating, in other words, when you're operating with an entirely different internal principle of action and principle of engagement with the world for all people, not only does that stick out because people are mostly selfish, they sense there's something that this guy's operating based upon a completely different system. If that exists on a national level instead of on an individual level, that gets the regard of the nations of the world. That episode is expressed in the story in the Bible with King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. She heard about the tremendous wisdom of King Solomon and the Jewish people, and she had to investigate herself. You know what I'm saying? That's when this is on, not on the individual, but on the national level. Imagine Jews were associated with the highest ethical behavior and standards. Right now, the association with Jews is good at money making, pretty funny, run Hollywood, you know, maybe running the media and the government. You know, that's a little bit of the nefarious anti-Semitic point. Unfortunately, we're not universally appreciated being ethical, having the highest ethical standard, because quite frequently I am a reader of the Wall Street Journal, and it is pretty frequent when there is an SEC investigation, conviction, indictment, etc. There's a Goldstein and a Shapiro and a Schwartz, and they could be even Orthodox, and it's embarrassing. So we're not there yet where we Jewish people are yet on the level of reflecting the highest ethical standards. We're known right now for good at money making. You know, it's like the old Curb Your Enthusiasm, like when he finds out that his lawyer is not Jewish. So we're good at, like, you know, like Donald Trump said, you know, he wanted to make sure that all of his accountants and lawyers are Jewish. You know what I mean? That's his stereotype, that good Jews are good accountants and lawyers, which is a truth. I think that is a true fact. I'm not going to deny that. But the truth is, that's not associated the same thing with ethical perfection. You know what I'm saying, Michael?
Yeah.
You know?
I'm following.
You know, so that's saying, that's why if they hit this level, not just following the commandments, but they're walking Hashem's path of ethical excellence, then all the nations of the world will realize God's name associated with you and be in awe of you. Because that's intrinsically awe-inspiring. We are way not there yet. I mean, we have individuals who are pretty awesome. We're not as a nation of awesome.
We are a nation of awesome, just not on that level of awesomeness.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. This is the standard. This is the gold standard of awesome. Of internal ethical excellence. Like, you know that you make a deal with a person, a Jewish person, you shake their hand, you know as good as a contract. Are we there yet? Some people it's true. Some people it's not true. You better get a lawyer and a notarized contract with a stiff penalty provision. And if the guy screws you over, he'll get nailed. That's where we're more at.
Rabbi Penny.
Yeah.
I have a shiva situation.
Yeah, lay it on me, baby.
So. Just try to gauge, because I have one of my next door neighbors growing up, his mother passed away. Funeral was today.
Okay.
They're not so religious. I believe they're sitting shiva till Friday morning.
Right. The classic 3-day special.
So what? I don't have all the information.
Right.
What do you think is the best optimal?
Well, try to find out where they're doing it, where they're sitting. And if you can go, it's going to be – especially when people having a very – by the way, when people do the short visits, the short shivas, right?
Yeah.
And they're going to be blown away, you know, if you show up. Or at least call. But you want to – if you can show up, find out from a common friend where they sit in shiva and go there. It'll blow their socks off.
Do you think, my only concern is, I should just ask the times, but would it be too late, you think, after work to go to,
like, how Orthodox shivas go till 10 p.m., right. Non-Orthodox shivas have visiting hours.
Right, I think that's what it is.
You got to find that out. So that would be, like, you know, uncool. They might not even be there. You know what I mean? You're going to, you know. So that's a general point. But
don't ask the source. Just try to find out from someone else the information.
Yeah. You don't have to. Yeah, it's a little bit tacky to call the I mean, if you have no choice, you got to call them up. You got to know where to go. But you see if you can find a common friend. Like, hey, where, you know, is there any Shiv information? You could, by the way, if you can call the place where, if you know where they had the thing, you can find out where all the information is. All right, guys. Have a great night. Lila Tove.
Thanks.
All the best. Catch you next week.
Robert Finney.
Yeah.
One more question.
Yeah.
What is an appropriate thing to send to a Shiva?